listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's only progressive talk station. Now, coming to you live from the banks of the Willamette River, it's Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman.
You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
Online at 620kpoj.com and on the air at AM 620 KPOJ.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland Smart Talk Station. I think that we live up to that. We are in a minute. We actually, Adrian Ackerman from the camp is on the line, or was on the line. We're going to hear from her in a minute. But as I promised, we have some people here in studio from what they call the real Occupy Portland. And when I got the call, I actually know Debbie. We met at an early GA meeting before the march. We spoke, we connected. I didn't know it was her. I had gotten some calls from people in my community because I'm the touch point Occupy person in my community. What's going on? I got lots of calls. There was a claim that something that was thrown through a bank window or at a bank window was attributed to an organization called the Real Occupy Portland Movement. My wife and many others came to me and said, well, what is this Real Occupy Portland Movement? And I said, I don't know. And then a few days later, I got a solicitation saying, hey, would you like to have us on the show? Yes, I would. I want to clarify. So we're having a few technical difficulties here. I don't have access to bios, so I'm going to have Julio and Debbie introduce themselves while we're doing this. Debbie, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, please? We have a bio. Well, before we get into that, this is live radio. We do have a report from Adrian, so we're going to get into that in a minute. Hold on. Adrian, it's Adam Klugman. Yeah. You have an update for us.
Yes, I do. It's pertinent to our last conversation. As soon as I got back to camp after getting off the phone with you, I was approached by one of our lead peace and safety liaisons who just had a conversation with Chief Reese. He was confrontational in that conversation and made it adamantly clear that they are intending on using whatever force they need tonight to disperse crowds, and they're going to use whatever tactics are at their disposal and means of doing so are at their disposal. So I just really want to make a call out to your listeners. If you're able to come down tonight and participate in legal observation, we could really use your help. We're committed to nonviolence, and this assertion that they are going to move in with force, even if they're not confronted with violence, is alarming to us. And the only thing you need to do to be a legal observer is come down with a phone you can type on or a piece of paper and a pen, and then you can submit whatever you observe to the National Lawyers Guild, and specifically Stu Sugarman from the National Lawyers Guild.
How would you identify yourself as a legal observer? Is there a color you can wear?
You don't have to wear any color. Anyone can do it. The colors are green, but you don't need anything. Anyone can be a legal observer.
And what time do you want people to come down, Adrian?
Well, 12:01 is the eviction notice, and like I said before, that could be, it could happen anywhere between 12:01 and when the parks reopen at 7, I believe.
Great. Adrian, thank you so much. If you can get down there, thanks so much. We will be there. I will get down there. If we can, we need to support them. If they're going to come in with force, we need people observing that and holding the line towards nonviolence and peace. Not one person hurt in this eviction. Sorry to Julio Granda and Debbie Hellman. We needed to get a quick update. These are two people that I know a little bit. They are from a movement called the Real Occupy Movement. As I've said before, I bristled instantly at the name, but I don't shy away from difficult conversations because those are the ones that really count. Julio Granda currently sits on the board of directors of the newly formed Real Occupy Movement, a nonprofit that intends to raise money to assist the Occupy Movement of 2011 to advocate and support for change of the socioeconomic injustices that plague our country. In the spirit of this movement, TROP is planning to network with all the Occupy City to coordinate nationwide campaigns. Debbie Hellman, why don't you just go ahead and tell us about yourself a little bit before we get into it?
Okay, I sit on the board of the Real Occupy Portland nonprofit as well. Same goals as this you just read for Julio.
Uh-huh.
I originally got involved in the Occupy movement days after the group decided to form the movement. I was one of the original 15 that met at Powell Books.
Right, we met, I remember.
Yes, I originally was camping at the camp. I was there for approximately the first week.
Uh-huh.
After that, I had to go home. I do have other responsibilities. I'm still passionate and dedicated to the Occupy movement, but I wanted to refocus. I decided to make a horizontal move from the camp to help expand the movement outside the camp area. I believe the camp is a great tool to let everybody know what the Occupy movement is about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it needs to expand. We need to let other people in the community and involve other people in the community with what's going on with the Occupy movement.
Our guests are Debbie Hellman and Julio Granda from the Real Occupy Movement, self-named. Julio Granda, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Good evening. I started off with the Occupy Portland movement. Initially, I think the first GA that occurred over at the Waterfront Park, attended all the GAs, got involved into the tactical committee and the safe and peacekeeping committee. At the October 6th march, I held the bullhorn that charged the march throughout the whole march. I guess I basically was in the front. I didn't really lead it, but I just kind of charged in front. And I ended up, I would say, occupying at the parks, Lonsdale and Chapman. 3 days on, 1 day off, I would do 3 day shifts for the safety and peacekeeping. And then I would go home for about a day, sleep, come back, and I'd be recharged for the next 3 days. And I did that for about 3.5 weeks at that time when, you know.
So you were both very committed early supporters of the Occupy Portland movement. So why don't we start with you, Debbie? We'll bounce back and forth. Why did you guys start the Real Occupy Portland movement, and why did you make the choice to call it the Real Occupy? And I'll just say up front that my issue with that is that by calling yourselves the Real Occupy movement, by implication, that means that there's a fake Occupy movement somewhere, and I think that's what instantly caused me to bristle. So why don't you take that one on, Debbie?
That was never the intention of the name.
Okay. But you can understand why people would take that.
I totally understand. I believe it's more of a perception, but that totally was not the intention of the name.
Uh-huh.
We were trying to expand the Occupy movement in the Portland area.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the point where it's at right now, you have the people in the camp, but they are not the whole 99% of the people in the city or in the state or in the nation. And we felt like we needed to start, that it would be helpful if we started this nonprofit to support the movement,
right,
and to address all these other individuals that are in the 99% that are not able to camp, that have never been to the camp, that for one reason or another, that aren't necessarily interested in the camp that's in the parks.
Okay, so
we want to engage those people.
Was it a response to what you were seeing in the camps, Julio? I mean, was it something about you felt that the camp itself was not functional? I mean, well, it must have been a response to something.
Well, it was a response into the fact that there was quite a few things that I had proposed, and I just wasn't being heard.
You felt frustrated.
I felt frustrated. Uh-huh. I just felt like I wasn't gaining any ground into what I was passionate about.
What was that?
Well, basically, creating, supporting the cause to campaign and protest against the injustices and the reason why we're there. It seemed like a lot of the focus was truthfully in the camp and the process. And as a result, I took a lateral move.
I see.
Got together with Debbie and a few other people that were some of the original organizers to create the Real Occupy Portland as a nonprofit so we can raise money and support it in a different fashion than what the camp represented initially.
So let me see if I understand this, and Debbie, you take it. You felt that, and it makes sense, that when the camp got started, there were lots of logistical things that needed to be addressed. The GA was getting bogged down in process because that was what was required. It was the process and communication terms and how we're going to feed people and what are our policies going to be. And you guys felt frustrated, like there needs to be some organization doing some kind of meta work somewhere that isn't just bogged down in the logistics of the camp. Is that a fair assessment?
That's correct. Accurate.
That's accurate, yes.
Okay. So was there a feeling of, you know what I mean? Like to call it the real Occupy movement feels a little bit like there's there was some bad feelings about it, like a sticking your tongue out as you're going. Like, could you call it the trans Portland Occupy movement or something? The meta, because I really feel that. It feels divisive, and I'm having trouble getting over that, even though I see that your intentions weren't that.
Adam, that's completely inaccurate. It wasn't a divisive move. As a matter of fact,
it was not intended that way.
Not at all.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, laying the cards on the table, I personally, I don't know about Debbie, but I personally came up with the name, loved the name, and personally felt that it was going to be a little controversial and it was going to get attention not only from the camp, but nationwide and locally. And that's what was going to help us propel forward and be able to open up what the original movement is about, which is the cause to fight the injustices, to fight the oppression that's been happening for the last 60, 70 years?
Yeah, it was an expansion. It was an expansion of the Occupy movement in the Portland area. I understand the controversy as well. But at the same time, just like Julio said, it's bringing attention to the Occupy movement as a whole. And that's what we need, is we need positive attention on the Occupy movement. This is bringing that attention to the Occupy movement, opening it up to people that necessarily weren't seeing what was going on in the camp, didn't necessarily agree what was going on in the camp. And now we're getting their attention to focus on what the initial goal of the Occupy movement was about, which was the financial industry and the corrupt politicians that put us in this position.
Is there a website?
There is a website.
What is it? Go ahead and give it.
It's realoccupypdx.org.
That's
www.realoccupypdx.org. Yes.
I'm intrigued. I'm going to read your mission statement. We're going to run out of time in a minute, and I want to give you guys a shot. Here's their mission statement. We are concerned citizens and some of the original organizers of the Occupy Portland in synergy with the Occupy Wall Street movement. We are committed to addressing a corrupt system of financial industry and politicians that are responsible for our socioeconomic crisis locally and nationally. I want to give you each time to have a parting shot on this. I wish we had more time. Maybe we'll have you guys back to expand on that, and we will be in touch. Debbie Hellman. This is the Real Occupy Movement. It's the realoccupypdx.org is the website. Debbie?
Yes, it is. And I'd like everybody to go to our website and take a look at it. And any help we can offer to any Occupy movement on the coast or in the country, we'd be more than happy to do that. And we're hoping to, unite with everybody and propel this movement forward.
Great. What kind of help, Julio, what kind of help would you be offering to other Occupy movements?
We're offering support, logistical support in the form of planning, fundraising, donations as well. Yeah. Well, we have the means, obviously, and we're just getting started. So
sure.
The pot's pretty small. Consulting. We did it here in Portland. We've been through a lot. I think we weathered the storm. I think the storm they're about to go through here, I think, is a more of a learning experience. And I think that we're going to come up pretty strong. We're going to rise up and resurface stronger.
Our guests are Debbie Hellman and Julio Granda from the Real Occupy Portland movement. This is their self-name. Their website is www.therealoccupypdx.org. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Check them out. If you have questions for them, call them, contact them. I have a feeling this isn't the end of this conversation. I want to keep in touch with you guys. I'm still going to push for a name change. But I like the work that you're doing, and I like the idea of trying to take a meta approach that can connect all of the Occupy movements, and I appreciate your efforts and coming on the show and taking some of my abuse. You guys, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Real Occupy OccupyPDX.org. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ Portland Smart Talk Station. When we come back, I have an interview with a guy named Greg Palast that I Skyped. He's a good buddy of mine. He's a brilliant guy and a total madman who's written a new book called Vulture's Picnic. You want to check this out. This guy's out of control and brilliant. We'll be right back.
Isn't it? This is Mad as Hell in America. Portland's Progressive Talk, 620 KPOJ.
You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's smart talk station. I dig it. Okay, so we're going to take a break from all this heavy thinking and take a little journey with one of the true journalists left on the planet. His name is Greg Palast. He is brilliant, fearless, and completely out of his mind. I was hoping to have him on the show live, but he's actually on his way to Portland right now. And so he couldn't come on the show live. So I Skyped an interview with him. The whole thing ran about 40 minutes. I had to cut it down to 18 minutes. So we're going to play it in two segments. We're going to play a long 12-minute segment, and then we're going to go to a break, and then we're going to come back and play the final 6-minute segment of it. The cool thing is that Greg Palast is going to be here tomorrow, Sunday, November 13th, at the Baghdad Theater at 6 p.m. For tickets, you can log on at gregpalast.com. You can log on at the name of the book, which is vulturespicnic.org, vulturespicnic.org. He's going to be here tomorrow. I'm going to shoot down there. Gotta see the guy. He's just a wild man. Wait until you hear this interview. It's self-explanatory. Let's roll it. When you look under muckraker in the dictionary, there is definitely a picture of our next guest. His name is Greg Palast, and he is author of the New York Times and international bestsellers, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and Armed Madhouse. He turned his skills to journalism after two decades as a top investigator of corporate fraud and racketeering. Palast is best known as the investigative reporter who uncovered how Catherine Harris purged thousands of African Americans from Florida's voter rolls in the 2000 presidential election. His latest book is Vulture's Picnic: In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. In his own words, the book is pulp nonfiction, where we follow Palast on both a political and a personal journey where he, quote, gets drunk, gets sober, gets laid, and gets arrested. Greg Palast will be appearing in Portland for the international launch of his book, Vulture's Picnic, in Portland at the Baghdad Theater at 6 p.m. That's this Sunday, November 13th. Tomorrow, you don't want to miss it. For tickets and information, log on at gregpalast.com. Greg, welcome to Mad as Hell in America.
Hey, glad to be with you. And they can go to vulturespicnic.org, hit tours, and you'll get right there to the Portland information. But I'll just see you at the Baghdad tomorrow night.
So, Greg, where are you in the world right now?
Well, I have just stopped in from Sarajevo, Bosnia, the Congo, and just landed long enough in New York to shower and get on the plane for Portland. I actually did stop also after the Congo. I went into the heart of darkness, Brooklyn, where I was tracking down. No kidding. This is for BBC, where I jumped. I was staking out and jumped one of these vultures that gave the book the name Vulture's Picnic. One of these. Well, I shouldn't call him a vulture. He should be called, according to Herman Cain, a job creator. Financial vultures are now. So I'm going to change the book from Vulture's Picnic to Job Creator's Picnic. Because I just found out that ripping off the Congo, stealing the money that was meant for to end the cholera epidemic. I'm not making this up. The guy gets a hold of this by bribing the prime minister of Bosnia. This is an American financial speculator. This stuff is illegal in most of the world. In the United States, these vultures have become the number one donors to the GOP. Since Ken Lay shunted his mortal coil, the head of Enron, these are the guys who've taken over. This is the 1%. And, you know, I guess they're job creators if you consider, you know, undertakers in the Congo and the massive unemployment in Bosnia. And then, of course, hey, the other side of it, at least the one good thing about these guys is that they don't pay taxes in the United States.
So let's get into it. Tell us about your new book, Vultures Picnic. Our guest is Greg Palast. GregPalast.com is the website. He's going to be here tomorrow, Sunday, November 13th at the Baghdad Theater at 6 p.m. His new book is called Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. Tell us about this political, this pulp nonfiction of yours and how it relates to this 1% discussion the world is having.
Well, I'm investigating these guys. I take you to their homes, which are bigger than the Vatican. You get to meet their trophy wives. You see how they spent their money and how they got it. The blood, the bribes, the babes, the whole thing. And because those who've read, like, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is number one in Portland for quite a while.
We love you here, Greg.
Love is a much abused concept, but we'll discuss it. The trick is, and by the way, I'm going to return the love because I talked my capitalist pig publisher into giving out the first chapter for free if you go to vulturespicnic.org excerpts. They don't like that. I don't know why. But the thing is that I want to take you with me on the investigation. It starts out, I'm on a stakeout with one of these financial vultures, one of the one percenters, and it's a snowstorm. Well, first, by the way, I got John McEnroe to agree to do the stakeout with me. What we were going to do is we were going to have to get permission to film on this guy's monster estate. I was going to have McEnroe had agreed to do a thing where I would have cameras and we'd be making a reality show. So you think you can play tennis with John McEnroe. I'm not making this up. You know, the great tennis player. He agreed to do this. But then, of course, it started snowing. So the tennis, to suggest we can play on the guy's tennis court was not going to fly. So I bring out my little red 14-year-old Honda, and of course it's snowing. Now everything's turning white, and I'm in the middle of this estate area, right? And there's this red Honda. So I've just blown it. You know, might as well have a big sign on there that says, you know, I am on a stakeout. So I zoom off to his office in New York, get to the big old office building, and I go up to this where they have this big investment bank, billion-dollar investment bank, and there's no signs, there's no nothing. They, in the half hour to get there, they unbolted the big plaques off the walls, took off all the nameplates, and I thought they disappeared. But in fact, they were, I hear some noise. They're hiding inside, I kid you not. They're,
get out
so you
of
have
here.
These multi-millionaires hiding in the dark inside their office in New York.
They're hiding from you?
Which is really, I really love that. Hiding from the guy in the red Honda, man. So the core of the investigation is British Petroleum, which takes me up to the Arctic, which takes me to the middle of Asia, which takes me to the middle of the Amazon. A lot of frequent flyer miles in this investigation, a lot of weird stuff. So I get a call from the Caspian Sea, from the nation of Azerbaijan. And I know where you, Adam, what is the capital of Azerbaijan again?
I don't know.
You're right. You don't know it because no one knows these capitals until the 82nd Airborne arrives there, you know, Mogadishu, Saigon, you know, you name it.
Right.
No, it's one of these little Islamic republics pooped out by the Soviet Union when it died. But it has a lot of oil. And I get a cable from the Caspian when the deep water horizon blows up.
Right.
And it says, this has happened before. Click. You know, well, what do I do now? Well, if I were Anderson Cooper, I'd go to the gym. But right. Since I work for BBC, I have to go get on an airplane and somehow talk my way into the Islamic Republic, get the evidence, and talk my way out. Getting in is not easy. Getting out was very difficult because I get arrested. That's that arrested stuff. I get arrested on the way. When I'm in there, I'm going across the desert to try to get to the BP oil terminals. And they grab me, and this number two in the secret police shows up. I don't know what's going on here, but they take, of course, the first thing, they don't want a diplomatic business, so they're going to let me go. I know that eventually, but they take the film. That's what they want. And so, of course, they're slap happy. They, you know, these toy soldiers run off happy with my film. They let me keep my pen without realizing that I had one of those little Austin Power pen cameras where, you know, you. So I had the information on the pen.
Your life.
Though, man, I have to say, when life. I got
like you said, you can't make this stuff up, man.
I know. Well, see, that's the thing. If it were in a James Bond movie or a James Bond thing, he'd say, it's a movie. This is weirder. In fact, actually, you know, by the way, the number one, the first vulture we go after, the first chapter is called Goldfinger, because one of the key financial vultures, or I should say financial job creators in America, and that's featured in Vulture's Picnic, is Goldfinger, the real one, not the James Bond one. And the one in James Bond is like a Girl Scout compared to the real Goldfinger. So I'm chasing this guy around the planet. He bribes the president of Zambia. We follow the president of Zambia, my sidekick Bad Penny, who that's her real name, by the way. In the meantime, all this stuff is tied up with the big banks. These are not small biters. These are billionaires. And it's – so I have these documents from inside the U.S. Treasury. Tim Geithner, who's the Secretary of the Treasury, writing a cable to – confidential cable to Larry Summers. He's the – was the economic czar, right, under Obama and also under Clinton. And it's their goofy, insane plan to force deregulation of banks on the whole planet. Which is, you know, like saying we're going to make everyone join the leper colony. You know, it's just like madness. But it's quite a document. And the document, and here's the weird thing. If you're – okay, alert. Conspiracy nuts, take this down. You will love this. They say before we can do anything to change the world order of banking, we have to have one final check-in with the CEO of Citibank, JP Morgan, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs. And I got their names and their private phone numbers there. And it's in Vulture's Picnic, by the way. Those are real live phone numbers, the private phone numbers of the top bankers on the planet. And I think that my publisher, Penguin, thought it was like a, you know, kind of a pseudo-illustration, wasn't for real. It's for real. I'm sure the numbers have changed by this week.
I bet they've changed the numbers by now.
Our guest is Greg Palast. GregPalast.com is the website. He's going to be here tomorrow, Sunday, November 13th, at the Baghdad Theater at 6 p.m. His new book is called Vulture's Picnic: In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. Greg, you said something just in passing, but I want to go back to it. You know, Bad Penny gets this phone call in which says this has happened before, and I don't think anybody's heard that the Deepwater Horizon event had happened. There had been other instances of this. Can you clue us in about that?
What happened was, I get this tip off that there was a Deepwater Horizon, almost identical blowout at another BP rig, same thing, same cause, this crappy cheap cement that they use, Kwikset, you know, time is money in oil, right? And it blew out before in the Caspian Sea. Now, the thing is, how do you cover that up? The answer is massive bribes, beatings, babes always in there, you know, because it's got to grease things up. But that's how they covered this whole thing up. But I had to prove it. I had to get in there to get this information. That's what's interesting. And I want you to come with me on these things so you have an idea of to what lengths they will cover it up. Because you have to, when I talk about the lengths they go to get this stuff, is indicating how deep they bury this stuff. And so I go from, you know, British Petroleum to you know, you end up with the Fukushima reactor where I get the information. I have the right. In fact, I'm sitting actually in front of the files from the nuclear plant builder. And there's a I have the notebooks of the engineers from when these plants were built in the 80s. And the notebook of the engineer of the guy who's in charge of what's called seismic qualification. That means when a plant shakes and another earthquake, he says, and this is a quote, there is no way can this plant withstand an earthquake. This is from the engineer's notebooks. We have this stuff, and people should see this stuff. And you go to vulturespicnic.org, you'll see some of these, like the secret filming. You'll see the films that go with the book if you go to vulturespicnic.org. But even better, come and see me. I'll show you the stuff.
That ends part one of my interview, my Skype interview with Greg Palast, who is going to be here in Portland tomorrow. That's November 13th, Sunday, at the Baghdad Theater at 8 o'clock. This book just sounds fascinating. I checked out the first chapter of it. You know, what's different about this is, look, Greg is a hardcore journalist for The Guardian. That's the equivalent of the New York Times. This guy's veracity is unassailable. And what he does is go around the world ambushing the 1%. What he calls vultures. And he says they're having a picnic at our expense. And we know that that's true. When we come back, we have part two of our interview with Greg Palast. And in the last segment, I'm going to wrap up and take your calls. This is Matt as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. We'll be right back.
Matt as Hell in America. Now on 620 KPOJ.
Back to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's smart talk station. I'm kind of enjoying the smart talk station because based on the listeners that it shouldn't be called the smart talk station. It should be called the smart listener station because, man, we have had some really smart listeners and callers today. This has been a difficult, but I think productive conversation. I want to remind people that we are on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and type in Mad as Hell in America. And you can send me an email at adam@madashellinamerica.com. I make the vow that I will return them all. Sometimes a few slip through the cracks, but I do love hearing from you. I have a few here that just, it just feels good to get them. Because I know that that way people are listening and responding. It's nice to see it written down. adam@madashellinamerica.com is my email. I really like hearing from you, and I will write you back. So we have taken a break from talking about the Occupy movement. We're going to come back to it in the last segment. We have been conducting an interview, a Skype interview, with Greg Palast. GregPalast.com is the website. He is going to be here in Portland for the international launch of his new book, Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum, Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. In his own words, the book is pulp nonfiction, where we follow Palast on both a political and a personal journey where he gets drunk, gets sober, gets laid, and gets arrested. So what's different about this is that he takes you along on the journey. It isn't just a journalistic account, although Greg is a journalist of the very highest caliber for The Guardian. They don't like him here in this country because he has a tendency to tell the truth, and that's not something the mainstream media is particularly fond of. However, he does enjoy great notoriety and respect in England. He is a reporter for The Guardian, which is their version of the New York Times. This is a guy with a hell of a lot of street cred. He has spent the past year or so going around the world, or 2 years, ambushing the 1%, the people he calls the vultures, the petroleum pigs, the power pirates, and the high finance carnivores. Here is part two of my Skype interview with Greg Palast.
Let's shift subjects a little bit. Talk to me about the Chicago Boys and this Milt Friedman market fundamentalism that's still kind of playing itself out in our system and how it really factors in to what we're seeing today.
Well, in the book, I confess to a very dark past. Mm. I was on the wrong path. I was a student of Milton Friedman. I was one of his protégés at the University of Chicago when they're coming up with the New World Order. Well, but actually, and here's the fun part, it was my first investigations. I was actually sent in there by Chicago's labor unions to find out what this little wacky little dwarf was doing. And Friedman really took to me because I was investigating that these big multinational corporations could evade all. We used to regulate banks and the flow of capital. You couldn't just, you know, play at your computer and move billions of dollars across national lines. It used to be a crime. Right?
Right
now, it's now you're a job creator, right? If you move all your capital out of Greece and the whole thing blows up in flames, you're a job creator. You're not just a vicious vulture speculator. So I worked with Friedman, but and unfortunately he actually took some of my stuff. He thought it was brilliant that the you know, when I saw the kind of world order, any type of control over finance collapsing, he thought, oh, that's brilliant. He says, isn't that wonderful? It was like, It was quite strange. And actually, you know that thing in Network, the film Network,
my favorite movie.
There's a soliloquy where the captain of industry says to the newsman, "Look, the money flows out. Billions are going to the Arabs. It goes out and we must get it back. It flows out and it comes back, and it flows out and it comes back." It was actually a redo of a piece I'd written with Friedman.
Really?
Which had gone to my uncle was a Star Trek writer. I never told this story to anyone. Actually, this is interesting. My uncle was a writer for Star Trek, and his best friend was Pat Chayefsky, who was writing Network at the time. And so Chayefsky got it exactly. So he heard this story. He said, "Well, great. You know, the money flows out. It flows in. That's how it is." But what it is, it's sick. It's nasty. We are vulture food. That's the problem. These guys don't make money by creating jobs. They're waiting for us to die so they can pick at our carcass. That's why it's Vulture's Picnic.
I just can't help but feel that this is all going too well for these vultures, and that there isn't really it's more than just like systematically extracting wealth for their own benefit. Sometimes I get the sense that they are deliberately trying to break the financial backbone of the world, and that somehow that's going to benefit them. But I can't always get my head around it. Am I just too far out on the conspiratorial limb here, or do I have something right?
Both. You're way out of the conspiratorial realm, and you're dead right. So, for example, one of the problems with Greece, for example, is that and in the mortgage market, which was we are greased in America, yeah, in the housing market, is that operators like Goldman Sachs were allowed, which was never allowed before, they had what was called, they're found to have been holding what are called net short positions. That's a fancy term that the SEC uses for you're betting that things will die. You'll make money when the securities you sell are going to go bad.
So William Kunstler, the lawyer from the Chicago 7, said that the worst crimes in history have always been perpetrated under cover of legality. Your Uncle Max has a slightly different version of that same statement laid on us.
Uncle Max was a gangster. He had a gang that was competing with Al Capone in Chicago. Uncle Max controlled the Near North Side. Capone controlled the West Side, Cicero. And Uncle Max grabbed Capone's slot machines when Capone tried to put his slot machines in Max's territory. And Uncle Max, he had Capone's machines thrown in the Lincoln Park Lagoon. Well, Capone let Maxie keep his kneecaps, but that was about it. He lost the territory to Capone. But what Maxie said, you know, I got to tell you, Capone's a schmuck, because he said the real money is being made by those who steal legally. And it's funny that's the point. These guys legalize their crimes. And in the section I call the Generalissimo of Globalization, I talk about basically things that – when we talk about deregulating banks, deregulating energy, we are really talking about decriminalizing what used to be considered fraudulent profiteering behavior. It's not deregulating, it's decriminalizing. These vultures are in a different moral setting than we are. They really are ubermensch. They're like outside the moral sphere that we're used to. So, you know, that's the point in Vulture's Picnic, is that I don't want to go after too many books are written about evil corporations, even like British Petroleum. I want you to actually meet these individuals. Mm-hmm. British Petroleum is the name of a company. I want you to meet Lord Brown, Mr. Bribery, right, Mr. Brutality himself. You're going to meet these characters and the agents and the girlfriends and all the rest. And so at least you have a weapon in your hand. I don't want you to be out there unarmed intellectually.
I want to tell my listeners to buy the book Vulture's Picnic by Greg Palast. It's called Vulture's Picnic: In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. As you can tell, it is going to be one hell of a ride. Greg is going to be in Portland on Sunday, November 13th. That's tomorrow at the Baghdad Theater at 6 p.m. Greg, I will definitely be there. I want to shake your hand and get a good look at you. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Adam, you're terrific. See you then.
Well, that concludes our interview with Greg Palast. I just really like this guy. I've loved him and admired him since Armed Madhouse. Guy is just amazing. When we come back, and he's a lunatic. He's just completely out of his mind. And I think that's what I like about him. He's like spot on journalist, muckraker, and lunatic all at the same time, as you could hear. And he's going to be at the Baghdad Theater tomorrow night at 6 p.m. I'm definitely going to be there. I hope I will see you there. For tickets, go to gregpalace.com or vulturespicnic.org. You can find out everything you need to know. When we come back, I'm going to take your calls, 503-248-0620, 1-866-452-0620. We'll be right back.
This is Mad as Hell in America. Portland's Progressive Talk, 620 KPOJ.
So, where to?
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's smart talk station. I want to give everyone a heads up. There is going to be a single-payer march on November 19th at noon. It starts at NATO and Salmon. That is a single-payer march, November 19th. It starts at 12 noon at NATO and Salmon. Do I need to say it again? One more time, a single-payer march on November 19th. It starts on NATO at Salmon at noon, excuse me, on November 19th. I've got a call on the board. Jeff's been holding a while. Appreciate you holding, Jeff. I want to have some time to conclude, but go ahead and let her rip.
Okay, thanks, Adam, as always, for taking my call. I wouldn't disagree with anything from your opening statement, and I'd strongly join you in the call for nonviolence and peacefulness.
Yes.
I do want to point out the obvious that revolutionary change has always been messy. If it was as easy as electing a shiny, eloquent president, we would have gotten it 3 years ago. And with the Occupy movement, I do believe the medium is indeed a big part of the message. These occupiers are the tip of an iceberg of frustration and desperation with the huge inequalities in our society. By occupying a visible public space as opposed to office space, they're showing solidarity with Occupy Wall Street, illuminating the issues of Wall Street greed, as well as our country's distorted financial priorities that emphasize industrial-sized killing around the world, as opposed to healing and educating our own people and giving us the Green New Deal that we desperately need.
And it seemed to me that we were promised. I appreciate. Go ahead, Jeff.
And having said that, Adam, I do want to say that I think Sam Adams can reach out. He's repeatedly said he supports the movement. I think he could reach out and offer the occupiers an out or compromise tonight, which would be to clear only one of the two parks.
That's not going to happen, Jeff. They're coming in and they're going to clear that park. That's what's going to happen. He is not offering any compromise. I do appreciate the call, and I just want to follow up, Jeff, and just say this, that I support occupying public space. I think having Tangerina and I were talking about this off the air. It is absolutely critical, and I appreciate the call, Jeff. We must occupy public space. Our job is not to be convenient. Our job is not to be pretty. Our job is not to be something that the system can go, oh, look how wonderful that is. Our job is to put it in their face and speak truth to power. But we must do this in a way that is completely uncompromising in its commitment to nonviolence. Because behind nonviolence and our insistence on nonviolent non-cooperation is a provocation that brings forth everyone's humanity. That was Gandhi's whole philosophy, that the force is satya, a love force, truth force, that will transform the world if we will let it. We don't have to do it. It will do us if we will allow it to happen through us. So to the Portland occupiers tonight and to the police that are going to clear them out, I wish, I hope, and pray that you will place your humanity at the forefront of every choice that you make. This is Adam Klugman. Wishing peace to everyone tonight. No one gets hurt.